95% of our lives are run and created by our subconscious mind programming. Imagine if your subconscious mind is running many negative, disempowering, and self-sabotaging programs. How will that 95% of your life turn out to be? Would you like help to change your subconscious programming into something that works for you and set it to attract and create everything you desire? Join Tamara Oviatt in her show Metaprogramming and the Human Biocomputer here on OM Times, where she will connect to the source energy and change your subconscious programming by deleting your negative belief systems. Tamara is the founder of Sacred Activations, a subconscious metaprogramming modality that rewires your brain and shifts hundreds of your belief systems so you can break away from lack, pain, and suffering, and take control of what you want to create in your life. Tamara has helped hundreds of thousands of people worldwide, and she is here to help you too. It's not about fighting what you don't want. It's about creating what you do want. And the only way to do that is to change and upgrade your subconscious programming. Let Tamara help you create magic in your world. Tune in every week at Metaprogramming and the Human Biocomputer.
Hi, welcome to the OM Show. I've got Dr. Sanjay Gupta with me, and I am so excited to interview him today. He's a cardiologist out of the UK. He's absolutely amazing. I found him on YouTube because my blood pressure was really, really high. And I went to the doctors and they put me on medication, and it's like, there's no way I'm doing this. What do I need to do? So I started doing some research, and I found Dr. Gupta, and I was off the medication within 10 days. I was taking more magnesium and potassium, and everything's fine. My blood pressure is perfect. And I did a blood test, and it was funny because when the blood test showed that I was low in salts, and I'm living in the Yucatan, so I know we're burning through a lot more salts. And with the work I do, I know I burn through a lot of magnesium. So I was absolutely thrilled. And I think everybody needs to know this. I know so many people that are on heart medication. How do we help these people? What do we do, doctor?
Yeah, I think the first thing to understand is that even though doctors may pretend that they know everything, the reality is they don't. Unfortunately, we live in a world now where it's all about guidelines. You know, someone tells us what to do and you just get on and do it. And in some ways, the reason you do it is because you don't want to get into trouble. You don't want to come across as an outlier. And so, you know, it's very much a case of, well, we think a blood pressure of such and such a number is too high. Just hit everyone. Hit everyone. Everyone who has that number, just hit them. And the problem is, as the patient, you're not there to be thought of as a number. You're not there to be, you know, you are different. Everyone is different in their own way. And I think we have to be a lot more sophisticated about trying to treat the patient rather than treat the number or treat the population. I think we need to spend more time with the patient, understand what, you know, who they are, try and be more sophisticated about working out what their risk is, trying to work out also what they want, you know, what they want, what you want to practice medicine, which is aligned with that patient's values, with their beliefs, etc. So in that sense, I think what has really suffered is this doctor-patient connection where there's good communication and education of the patient. And when you do that, I think we both gain, the doctor gains as well as the patient gain, and we start learning a lot more from our patients rather than reading some kind of text that is produced by people we have no idea. It just comes to us, you know, the current guidelines now are. We have no idea who's written them. We have no idea what their motivation is. And, you know, in some ways, my allegiance should be to my patient, not to the guideline. Yeah. And that is what I think is missing. I really think that the world, I mean, either I'm going crazy or the world is going crazy. But I wanted to give you an example of this. I was called once to do a lecture on blood pressure. And I had physicians, cardiologists from America, and I had cardiologists from York, not from York, from Europe. And I started off with the simple question that what is high blood pressure? And the Europeans said, well, any value which is above 140 over 90 is high blood pressure. And the Americans turned around and they said, oh, no, no, any value which is over 130 over 80 is high blood pressure. And I said, great. Well, you know, why don't you just move all those Americans to Europe and you've cured their blood pressure? It'll be much cheaper for you. You get rid of those people. They're not going to be a burden on your health service. They don't need any medications because they're cured. And it all works. How ridiculous is it that you can cure a condition by changing continent? And so when we turn around and we think about it, we have to say that high blood pressure, surely the true definition of high blood pressure is not a number. The true definition of high blood pressure, at least this is what my logic tells me, is that number that does that person some kind of harm. If it isn't doing you any harm, it's not high for you. And so instead of going and treating a number, and unfortunately, the problem is, you know, the numbers are never reliable, and I'll explain why. But instead of treating a number, what you should be doing is you should be saying, is this number, whatever that number is there any evidence that this is harming you? And if it is, then let's think about dealing with it in some way. And if it isn't, let's leave you well alone. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen anymore. So people just think your number is this, and they would treat a 90-year-old in the same way as they would treat a 20-year-old. You know, the number doesn't discern between who is 90 and who is 20. You treat them both the same way. Well, there's a problem with that, because the 90-year-old is not interested in living till they're 100. The 90-year-old is interested in having a good, acceptable quality of life now. The 20-year-old may be interested in living till they're 80-odd. So it is wrong to treat them both in the same way, with the same treatment. What you have to try and understand is who this patient is, what are their risks, what are you actually trying to achieve? Some may argue that in a 90-year-old, you're doing them harm by trying to treat their blood pressure. They've made it to 90. Whatever they've done, no matter how high their blood pressure was, they've made it to 90. They've done what you're trying to achieve by themselves. Your medications are not suddenly going to turn around and make them live till 100. But what they may do is they may make them unwell. They may give them side effects. They may make them fall. And unfortunately, no one pays any attention to that. It is just treat the number, not treat the human being, treat the patient. It is treat the number. It is let us be protocol centered. Let us be test centered. Let us be number centered. None of this. I think you have to be patient centered. I think that is the important thing. And unfortunately, that doesn't happen. And I think this is a real problem in modern day medicine.
Absolutely, totally agree. I mean, I have a doctor, because I got COVID really bad. And I had a doctor, or I do have a doctor in Merida that I go to for IVs, for like vitamin IVs. I actually received a stem cell IV, which really helped me. And he saw the blood pressure thing. He said, and he told me, oh, unfortunately, you'll have to be on this rest of your life because it's a side effect of COVID. And I just went, there's no way I'm going to do that. There's no way that's for me. So I was really surprised to hear that out of him, that he's supposed to be, you know, an alternative source. And so I know it's just the programming and how everybody's taught. And so people go into the statistics and what they're taught, and they're not really looking at the patient. But like I said, I was off in 10 days and there's no way I'm doing this, you know? So, I mean, what do we say to doctors and to people to help them understand that, you know, it is different for everybody, and we do need to address the person instead of just the numbers?
You know, I think the first thing that we should all be curious about is the data. So the data is the data, right? The data is the data. Someone does an experiment and you find the results. The problem is, what ends up happening is we don't follow the science, we follow the scientist. That's the big problem. Right. So someone will come along and they'll say, oh, this is great data. And you don't know what their interests are, what their, where their, you know, what their vested interests are in this, but they'll say, oh, this is great. And suddenly everyone follows that. And no one says, show me the data. Because at the end of the day, what happens is you see a four-legged animal in the forest. Someone says, oh, it's a donkey. Someone says it's a lion. And then the followers will turn around and fight each other. And no one turns around and says, well, can I just see the animal for myself? Do these results, which should really be clear cut, because all research these days on telling us how good something is or is based on quantitative research. So with any quantitative research, there have to be some numbers. There have to be some numbers that tell you how good something is, and there have to be some numbers telling you how harmful something is. So what we should be doing as doctors and as patients is saying, okay, you know that research that you are basing your guideline on, can I look at the numbers for myself? Do these numbers make sense to me? If, you know, and you'll go to your doctor and they'll say, and you'll say, okay, he'll say, oh, hey, you know, you've got high blood pressure. We've got to lower your blood pressure. And you say, well, why? Oh, because it's good for you. Why? Oh, it'll reduce your risk by 30% of having a heart attack or a stroke. And unfortunately, at that point, we stop. What we should be saying is, that's fine, but you first tell me what my risk is. Then we'll talk about lowering it by 30%. You know, if my risk is 1 in 1,000,000, then I don't want to take a tablet all my life to lower that risk by 30%. I don't even care if you lower my risk by 300% when it's that low. So this is the problem. We don't know our risk. We just get this message that we'll lower it by 30%, we'll lower it by 50%. That's a bit like saying, going to someone who sells you a lottery ticket and you say, well, the first thing you would do if you buy a lottery ticket from someone is, what are my chances of winning? Right? That's the first thing you would do before you buy a lottery ticket. Unfortunately, what is happening with modern day medicine is they'll say, don't worry about that. Buy two and you'll double your chances.
Right.
Right. That's what they do. So that's the problem, that everyone uses these kind of numbers to impress us, whereas actually no one actually talks about the absolute numbers. And I was actually having a debate with some of my colleagues today, and I said, you know, tell me about the numbers, tell me about the absolute numbers. And they said, well, actually the absolute numbers are 2%. So you treat 100 people and you make a difference to 2 people.
So what do you mean by 2%? 2% will have a stroke or a heart attack from high blood pressure?
No, what it means is that if you have high blood pressure and you treat it aggressively with medications, okay, as per current guidance, right, 98 out of those 100 people, you don't make any difference to. You only make a difference to 2 people. So 98 people take the hit of taking tablets for a benefit to 2 people. And the unfortunate thing is no one knows who those 2 people are going to be. So in some ways, you are being fed this idea that, oh, it's good for you. Well, it's good for someone, but the chances are it's probably not going to be you. And even if it were you, you would never know about it. What you do, however, know is that it'll cost you all your life. It will change your insurance premium because you're now told you have high blood pressure. It'll put the fear of God in you. Which will actually increase your blood pressure and will give you side effects. So I don't understand. You know, we make those decisions in our day-to-day life. We decide, is this the right time to cross the road? Is this the right place to put our money? We do that based on data. You know, we decide for ourselves. We make those important decisions ourselves. And here, when it comes to the medical profession, they say, oh, well, you don't know. You don't know. I'll make that decision for you. And actually what we need to do is we should be empowering our patients to say, okay, actually, why don't you ask me more questions? Because before I put you on this, this is going to be your life. I am labeling you. I am doing something which will have some kind of impact on your life. And maybe it's not going to be a good one. So while let's talk about numbers, let's talk about what we don't know rather than just concentrating on what we know. And right. Let's stop extrapolating data. So, you know, I get 100-year-old women who are being discharged on statin therapy. Well, how is that good? How on earth is that good? You know, but that's what happens. Because unfortunately, we have stopped asking questions, our patients have stopped asking questions, and therefore anything goes. You just say, this is what I was told to do, this is what I do, and that's it. You're not out. So there is a real need for patient education and patient empowerment. And I think we have to work as partners, you know, doctors and patients have to work as partners for the benefit of the patient, not a case of, oh, you come to me, I'm already assuming a role of being all-knowing, you know nothing, and therefore you should listen to me and do what I tell you to do. That is a complete nonsense. And I have so many doctors who were in this position who now come to me as patients, and they say, well, I don't feel comfortable taking statins. And I say, well, you've been doing this all your life and giving people, dishing them out like Smarties, and now it's your turn and you don't want it. So I think this is the thing. I think we as a profession have to be humble and start realizing that there's tons we don't know.
Right.
And sometimes it's not a bad thing sharing that with your patient, that there's all this we don't know. And what we know is here in front of you. This is what I know. You might as well know it because you are actually going to be the major stakeholder in this partnership. And what do you think? Does it work for you? And some people say, yes, in which case, let's go. And if some people say, no, I don't feel comfortable with it, that's okay too. You're not upsetting me by doing that. You're just expressing what is right for you. And I should be working with you on that and supporting you. And if something goes wrong, we turn around and say, okay, you know, I'm still here. I'm still here to support you. That's what we should be doing.
Absolutely. And what about like blood tests to check the vitamin levels for people before we put them on medications? I mean, is that possible? I mean, what do you do about that?
You know, the problem here is that no one does it. And yet what we do know is that our nutrition, what is going into our bodies, the adulteration of the food, there are so many other forces at work here, and none of them are geared towards our health. Most of these things are geared towards our wallets and our taste. You know, the food industry is not about health. Food industry is about taste. Food industry is that you sell something and you hope the person comes back and gets this. So I'm sure that all the adulterations that are happening in our food do result in all sorts of imbalances within our body. Mm-hmm. The problem, again, one of the big problems is A, no one looks into that, and B, we work with these normal ranges. So again, we treat numbers, you know, you don't treat patients. So if someone comes in and says, oh, I feel absolutely lethargic and I'm miserable, etc., and it all sounds like they've got thyroid problems or they've got vitamin D deficiency or whatever, the doctor will say, oh, well, it's normal range. You don't need it. And I don't believe that. I think you have to start thinking a little bit broader and you say, well, how do I explain this patient's symptoms? And sometimes the best thing is give them a little therapeutic trial, give them some medication, give them a little bit of replacement, see what happens. If you suddenly made them better, that's how we learn. We say, okay, that case, they had a low normal, I hit them hard and they got better. And therefore, maybe I have to revise my ideas of what is low normal, what are the normal ranges. Again, you see, so I'm not confident that the normal ranges cover the whole population. So I think that if you have unexplained symptoms, it's a very good idea to ask for a full profile. But even if you're running on the lower ends of the normal range, I think it's not an unreasonable thing to ask your doctor to try and see if correcting it or getting it higher makes you feel a bit better. Unfortunately, you'll have a much greater difficulty actually finding a doctor who'd be willing to be brave enough to do that. That is the problem. Doctors are not brave, willing to step out of their comfort zone. Anything like that, they're thinking in their minds, what will happen to me if I help this patient? What will happen to me? What trouble will I get into? Instead of thinking, what will happen to them if I don't help them? Where do they go next?
Yeah, absolutely. I know that's a big problem with the education of doctors, because they're educated through pharmacy drugs and how to prescribe those instead of health. You know, I talk a lot, you know, if you're driving a Porsche, are you going to put the best gas in it, or are you going to put the cheapest gas in it? Well, of course, you're going to put the best gas in it. Well, your body is your Porsche. You know, you treat it like you would your car. What are you putting inside? Because what you're putting inside is what's going to give you energy and health and everything else.
Absolutely. I mean, I think when you think about it, you know, bad things happen for a variety of reasons. You know, there's age, there's genetics, there's just pure old bad luck, and then there's lifestyle. And really, the only thing we actually have control over is our lifestyle. Right. And unfortunately, you know, there is no end of stress. And I think stress kills more people than anything else. Yeah. You know, there's very little emphasis on that. You know, they become little sound bites, but no one really, you know, governments need to look and say, well, what are we actually doing about reducing stress levels in the population? In places like the States and the Western world, the stress is incredible. You know, yeah. There was a time when about 30 years ago, you know, if you wanted to write a newspaper, an article or something, you would go to the library, you would go and find these big books called the Index Medicus, and you would spend the whole day and try and put everything together. Now you can do that in 5 minutes. Yet I am very confident we have less time now than we had in those days. So this is how much we've burdened ourselves. This is how much we've overloaded ourselves, you know, and I think it takes its toll. I think it's taking its toll. I think it's affecting our mental health, and I think it's affecting our physical health, and both mental and physical health cannot be disjoined, you know. And I think this is why, despite all the technological advances, despite all the fancy machinery and all the drugs, people are not living better. People are living worse. And even if we are increasing lifespan, we're doing it at the cost of people's quality of lives. And the lifespan we're increasing is not by very much at all. They're just not dying of our condition. They're still dying. It's just, oh, well, they didn't die of a heart attack, so we've made a difference. Well, they've still died. And unfortunately, when you start looking at all the data, it's all like, oh, he didn't die of a heart attack, or he didn't have a heart attack in 2 years. But actually, the number of people at the end of it all died anyway. So, right. So these are the fundamental problems. You know, research is massaged in such a way that it presents, it becomes palatable to people. And so it influences how we do things. And I think there's a real problem with that.
So what do you suggest to your patients when they come to you with high blood pressure?
Well, I say the first thing I want to know, okay, so if someone comes to me with high blood pressure, the first thing I want to know is, what is your blood pressure? And actually, if you get one of these home readings, these home blood pressure monitors that have become so common and everyone uses them, if you measure your blood pressure 20 times, you will get 20 different values. You will not get the same value, okay? So if you get 20 different values, which value are you going to say is my value?
Right.
And your doctor is comparing it with one value, but you've got 20 different values. So how do you use that then to A, decide whether it's high, and B, decide whether the treatment that you have been given is actually working? Because there's this kind of variation, you will never know. So I personally say, well, okay, so how do we do this? Well, someone somewhere did some research to say, oh, if you have very high numbers, you'll come to harm. Well, which number did he use? And if you look at all the research studies, they all use a 24-hour average, because 24-hour average recordings, which are done automatically by a blood pressure machine, which you have to get from the hospital, not one of those home readings, that will measure your blood pressure by itself, automatically, several times in a day and several times when you're asleep at night. And most people would argue that it is those readings that are recorded when you're asleep at night, when all the other confounding issues like stress and noise and traffic and everything has been taken out of the equation. Your blood pressure readings, the readings that you have at night, are your most accurate readings and most reflective of whether something bad will happen to you in the future. So I always do a 24-hour blood pressure monitor, and I say, okay, now at least we're dealing with one number. Okay, this is your number. And then I say, okay, now I'm going to work out whether this number is actually causing you harm. And if you think about it, the question is, how does blood pressure cause you harm? Well, pressure, if you have too much pressure in a container, the harm happens to the container. It's a little bit like a balloon. If you have too much pressure in a balloon, the balloon bursts. So I say, well, you know, your blood vessels could be likened to balloons, right? If the pressure is too high, the balloon will burst, and therefore the vessel will clot off, the blood won't get through. And that is the damage caused by high blood pressure. Let's look at your most fragile balloons. And the most fragile blood vessels in the body are in the back of the eyes and in your kidneys. So looking at the back of the eyes and saying, oh, do the blood vessels there look healthy? And if they look healthy, well, the blood pressure is not damaging them. And then you can actually even measure protein in the urine. So, you know, if you have damage to your kidneys, you will start leaking out small amounts of protein that cannot be measured otherwise, unless you specifically go looking for it. If you don't have that, if you don't have problems with your eyes, if your heart doesn't look more muscular, because if you're working against a higher pressure, you build more muscle. So if your heart doesn't look more muscular, then I say, well, your blood pressure is not harming you. And then if there is evidence of that, then I say, well, whatever your number is, let's do something about it. And then let's bring you back and repeat the test that we did, the 24-hour average, so that we're comparing apples with apples. And no one does that, you see. So this is fundamentally the problem. So you have no idea. In fact, I came across a patient the other day who went to their GP, and they said, oh, you know, your blood pressure is 140 over 90. We've got to hit you hard with blood pressure tablets. Okay. So the guy goes, he gets given some tablets. He takes them for a week. He goes back to the GP. And now the GP says, oh my God, your blood pressure is 160 over 110. Let's double these tablets. Well, if you think about it, that there is no logic to that. If you think about it, because if you are giving someone something to lower their blood pressure and they come back to you with a higher blood pressure, then there are only two possibilities. One, your measurements are inaccurate, or the medicine you've given them has actually increased their blood pressure. So it doesn't make sense to now double the dose of a medication, but that's what happens all the time. So, and the problem is that the measurements aren't accurate. You know, you will go in because you'll be a little bit anxious, so your blood pressure is going to be high. You've now been told you've got high blood pressure. Now you've been taking these tablets. Now you're really anxious because you want to know it's coming down. You go, your GP measures it, it's even higher. And the GP hits you even harder. After a few days, you start getting side effects. You feel miserable. You go back to the GP, and then the GP says, oh, hey, you're getting all this nausea. I'm going to give you a nausea tablet. And before you know it, you're on five different tablets. You start getting more side effects. You stop sleeping because some of these medications stop you sleeping. Hey, you've got anxiety. Let's give you another tablet. And before you know it, you're on 10 tablets, medicalized. And no one then has the energy or the courage to unentangle the mess, you know. So you just, it's much easier just to leave you on your 10 tablets and add a few more, rather than turn around and actually say, hang on, how much of this was actually helping you? And usually you will find that very little does.
Now, how do you untangle that? Say somebody's is caught up in that and they don't want to do that anymore. What would you suggest to them?
So I always go back to the principle that there are only two things that matter in life, quality and quantity, right? So any treatment has to either improve your quality of life or your quantity of life. So that then makes it very easy, because all treatments can be divided into things that make you feel a bit better or in some way make you live a little longer. Well, those things that make you live a little longer, you will never know about. So you have to rely on the data that tells you that this could make you live longer. So I take the data and I give them to the patient. I say, well, you know, if you take this medicine, the data suggests that this increases longevity by 2 months. What do you want to do? Do you want to take it? Do you not want to take it? And then the other medications, which are for quality of life, I say, hey, great, with quality of life, it's easy. Come off the medicines, and if you feel better, great. And if you feel worse, then you know you need this medicine because you feel it's making you feel better, in which case continue it. So that's how we do it. And we try and take people off the medicines, and we ask them regularly, how do you feel? Because the last thing we want to do is compromise a person's quality of life for some kind of benefit and prognosis that the patient will never know about.
Now, I have my cousin's boyfriend. He is overweight. He needs surgery. He's on heart medication, and they told him he has to lose weight. But then he says he can't eat the food that helps him lose weight because he's on this medication. He's not allowed to have all these fruits and vegetables. What do you do?
Well, I think in this particular person, his problem is his weight. So I would address that, because you see, the problem here is that you are not tackling the underlying problem. You know, he's on all these heart medications because they're a symptom of his underlying problem. So what you're doing is, someone comes along and they're overweight and they're stressed and their blood pressure is high. The blood pressure is a scream. The body is screaming and saying, I'm unhappy. And what we're doing is we're silencing the scream. Unfortunately, we're not really doing anything about what is underlying this. So, you know, you lower the blood pressure and the patient goes home and he says, oh, I had high blood pressure, I'm taking these tablets. But because you haven't tackled the underlying problem, the next thing that will happen is this patient will then start manifesting high blood sugars. And then they'll go to the doctor and the doctor says, hey, guess what? You're diabetic. Let's hit that. And then they'll go back, you know, and so all we're doing, and this is why people are not getting better, because we're not tackling the underlying problems. We are basically working with numbers, and we're silencing screams that the unhappy, unhealthy body is using to let us know that there's something wrong. And that's what we're doing. And this is why we see this. And I don't necessarily believe, I mean, we get, you know, as a cardiologist, it's not uncommon. I'll go out to the coronary care unit and there'll be a guy there and they'll be like, oh, he's had a heart attack. And I'll say, well, why has he had a heart attack? Well, he's diabetic for 20 years. That's why he's had a heart attack. And I said, oh, he's diabetic for 20 years. Yeah, that's why he's had the heart attack. And I said, has he been treated for the diabetes for the past 20 years? They said, yeah. So I said, well, then the treatment wasn't working. Why have we been treating him? Surely wasn't the whole purpose of treating him so that he wouldn't have a heart attack? And now that he has had a heart attack, we're casually just putting it down to the diabetes, which we have been treating for the last 20 years. That is telling us that we're treating the wrong thing.
Right.
But unfortunately, people don't actually turn around and have that insight. They'll just say, well, he had the heart attack because he's diabetic. Well, then what's the purpose of treating the diabetes? You are treating the wrong thing. And, and this is fundamentally one of the biggest problems. And I don't know whether, you know, I don't know how it is in the States, but diabetes has also become about treating numbers. You know, you hit a certain value, you are now diabetic, right? And if you don't hit that value, you're not diabetic. Well, what is really, really interesting is that the day you are diagnosed with diabetes, 21 to 30% of those people have already developed the complications of diabetes that take 10 years to develop on the day they're diagnosed. Well, surely you're using the wrong marker to make the diagnosis of diabetes. You want to use a marker that rises 20 years or 10 years beforehand. Because there's no point in making the diagnosis when the complications have already started happening. Yet, everyone still sticks with this this way. And unfortunately, when you look at the studies, managing those numbers, managing the HbA1c, just makes the HbA1c look nicer. It doesn't reduce macrovascular complications of heart attacks and strokes anyway. And yet, you know, the whole of the medical world continue going that way. They need to turn around and they need to be more introspective and say, we are dealing with the wrong thing here. There's something else going on, something that we're missing. And this is a big problem because we are lulled into this false sense of security. Oh, our HbA1c is not high. We are not diabetic. We're not in any danger. well, you may have that underlying horrible process going on in your body, and maybe the number rises too late. And you've missed the boat by that time. And therefore, once again, I urge people to be a little bit more sophisticated and spend less time putting all their faith in the medical profession, because the medical profession is hopelessly inequipped to try and go beyond guidelines and protocol.
I completely agree with you. This is a perfect time. We have to take a break. So we'll be back in 2 minutes, everybody.
Om Times TV. Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust, spheric approach. Om Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, Om Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an Om Times magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on Om Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive Om Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. Om Times. Open yourself to the possibilities. Do you want to go deeper into sacred activations, which is a subconscious metaprogramming process? Tamara Oviatt is inviting you to visit her website at tamaraoviatt.com to sign up and get lifetime access to free 7 activations that you can listen to anytime you want or as often as you need. If you like what Tamara does and like to incorporate sacred activations into your life, she also offers live webinars, masterclasses, and practitioners training to further support your healing, manifestations, and expansion. There are hundreds of activations on her website that address different aspects of your life: money, health, relationships, intuitive abilities, and more. Head over to her website at tamaraoviatt.com and experience the magic of sacred activations. Thank you for listening.
If I could be you, and you could be me for just 1 hour, if we could find a way to get inside each other's minds.
Walk a mile in my shoes. Walk a mile in my shoes. Well, before you abuse, criticize, and accuse, walk a mile in my shoes.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back. I'm so excited to have you here today and sharing all this information with you. I totally and completely agree with you. I want to talk about like magnesium and potassium and heart health and how do we help ourselves to be healthy with supplements to help our bodies?
I think the first thing to say is that there's no doubt that there are chronic shortages of certain vitamins and ions and minerals in our food. In our intake, and that's been shown. You know, a significant proportion of patients in the Western world, or people in the Western world, are deficient in magnesium because of a variety of reasons, such as modern day farming methods, the amount of sugar we're consuming, because when you know magnesium is something that is used in a lot of reactions. So if you consume a lot of sugar, and sugar is quite inflammatory in the body, we break down magnesium a lot more, we get rid of a lot more magnesium. A lot of people, you know, our gut health is not great, so we don't absorb as much. We take too many diuretics every day, so soda, stuff like that can encourage the loss of magnesium. So, and other things like stress breaks down a ton of magnesium. So all those things mean that we are deficient in magnesium. Unfortunately, there is no good test which is commonly available to measure your magnesium levels adequately. Okay. And whilst a lot of people think, oh, you could do a blood magnesium, all the studies have suggested that that doesn't correlate very well with how you respond when you are given magnesium as a supplement. So in my own experience, I think that whenever I have patients who come in with cardiac symptoms, heart palpitations, insomnia, restless legs, anything like that, I say, well, try some magnesium. And the reason I do this is because I know it is generally harmless in reasonable doses. So it has a very wide kind of therapeutic to risk, you know, thing. So you can take quite a lot of it before it accumulates in your body or causes you harm. So I tend to say to my patients, look, you know, I know it's not a dangerous supplement to take. Why don't you try it and see what happens? And I would say about 8 out of 10 people will come back and say, that magnesium has been good for me. It has helped me in some way, you know, particularly with heart palpitations, particularly in people who suffer from skip beats or flutters. And that's a you know, those symptoms, modern day medicine doesn't really have much to help those people, you know. But if you give them magnesium, 8 out of 10 people come back and say, that's really helped me. I've been amazed at how receptive people are to the recommendation of magnesium and how many people come back and say, I have benefited. When I've talked about this to my colleagues, they've turned around and say, oh, well, that's a placebo effect. And I say, well, who cares? If it makes the patient feel better, then that's all I'm after. I'm not after trying to work out I'm not after any kind of self-gratification. I'm after the patient says, I feel unwell. They take this thing that they feel comfortable taking, and they come back and say, thank you, I feel better. Great. Right. How is your medicine any different from that?
Exactly. And I see a lot of people, I mean, all my brothers and sisters are on heart medication, you know, and I'm not. I mean, I went down that road for a few minutes. I'm not going to be one of those. I'm not going to do that. So I started taking more magnesium and potassium, and I feel fantastic. I sleep great, and I'm calm. And doesn't the magnesium also help with the calmness in people's minds?
Absolutely. It has a lot of properties. Certainly in small experiments, it has a lot of properties which are good for us. It opens up our blood vessels. That's generally a good thing, you know, allowing more blood going around. It's an anti-inflammatory agent. So that's a good thing. It's a membrane stabilizer, so it helps with that. So it has a lot of properties which are generally good for the vascular system. Anything that opens up our blood vessels, encourages more blood to go through, reduces inflammation is good. So I think the nice thing about this is you notice that it makes you feel better, right? It's not making it worse. It's not hideously unaffordable, and you feel better as a consequence. We should be embracing that, you know. And one of the other problems with modern day medicine is in some way we've become very defensive. If someone chooses to go into an alternate route, we become very defensive and say, oh, well, that's all rubbish. And, you know, you need to listen to us. And actually, it shouldn't be about my discipline or your discipline. It should be about the patient. We should all be coming together for the benefit of the patient. And we should be saying, OK, well, you know, try that. And we're there to support you if things don't work out.
I love that you're doing this and you're standing up and you're speaking out. And I'm sure you're teaching a lot of the other doctors to do the same thing.
I think we all, at a certain age, when we start getting sick ourselves, we realize how much is lacking in what we've been offering. You know, so that I think is really, you know, I've looked after my father. My father was a doctor. You know, he developed dementia later on in life. And that concept of care was something I really noticed a lack of when I was looking after him. You know, it is all treating numbers. Okay, you know, we'll just give him this, and we'll give him a bit of that, and we'll give him a bit of that, and we'll do this, and we'll do that, and here's your bill for that. And actually what he wanted to do is, what they should have done is, look, let's leave him in his own home, let's support him the best we can in his own home, let's try and take away all those medications that really we're just doing to make ourselves feel better. That kind of thing is missing. And my father, you know, towards the end, he loved the idea that we could actually just give him clean, healthy food, supplement him. And he was more than happy with that, rather than okay, take this, and this is good for acid, and this is good for that. He absolutely hated it, absolutely hated it. It was the worst part of his day, having faced with taking 10 different tablets.
Right. So what is the best magnesium to take for your heart? Does it matter? I know there's some that's good for your brain. Not sure which one.
So the thing with magnesium, as far as, I mean, you know, I've not formally educated in nutrition, but my understanding is that if you just take magnesium on its own, it'll just go straight through your gut. So what you want to do is you want to take it with a binder, and the binder keeps it in your gut long enough for it to be absorbed. And so the goodness of the magnesium you're taking depends on the goodness of the binder. Those binders that keep it hanging around in your stomach for a longer period of time are generally better. Now, if you look online, most people talk about magnesium taurate being very good for the heart. However, I know the story about why they recommend magnesium taurate. Several years ago, I did a video on magnesium, and a ton of people came back to me and said, look, you know, which magnesium? And at that time, I didn't know very much. And I just said, oh, well, magnesium taurate is good. That was the one that just came up when I searched. And a bunch of people came back and said, oh, that magnesium taurate is amazing. And suddenly word just got out and everyone's like, magnesium taurate, magnesium taurate. Any magnesium that makes you feel better is fine. But I think in terms of binders, something like taurate or threonate, which crosses the blood-brain barrier and therefore apparently works better in the brain, are good. So magnesium glycinate, taurate, citrate, threonate. The one we don't recommend are magnesium oxide, because oxide is a bit like chalk. It just goes straight through your gut. So we don't recommend that. And those are unfortunately the commonest magnesiums you'll find in high street stores and supermarkets. You know, they give you the cheapest version. So it makes sense to get it from a proper health food shop. So something like magnesium taurate is fine.
Thank you. And then potassium also, or just magnesium?
Well, with potassium is slightly different to magnesium, because potassium doesn't have such a wide range, you know, where it can be safe. So potassium is kept within fairly narrow limits in the body. So too little and it can be harmful, too much and can be very harmful. And right. The blood test for potassium is a lot more reliable than the blood test for magnesium. So when it comes to potassium, I say go by your blood test. Of course, you don't want to be at the lower limits of normal. You want to be somewhere in the middle or higher levels of normal, but you don't want to be really exceeding those normal values, because we see it in day-to-day practice that when people greatly exceed those values, they come to harm. Whereas magnesium, on the other hand, you know, you can take 10 times as much and not really come to harm, because you just have diarrhea when it's too much and you just get rid of it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand that. Done that. Okay, so what other messages do you have with people with heart health and how they can live a happy, healthy life without being on major medications?
You know, I think the most important thing to understand is that there are very few medications. Most of the medications that we use are medications that have been tried out in patients when something is already broken. You know, there are very few medications out there which actually say, okay, well, you do this, you won't have a heart attack. Yes, once you've had a heart attack, there are medications that prevent you from having a second heart attack. And in that setting, I definitely think it is a good idea, wherever possible, when something has gone wrong, to do everything you can to try and prevent the thing from happening again. But in terms of keeping well, I definitely think that we need to pay attention to our nutrition. And I would certainly say things like sugar. Sugar is the biggest problem out there. Sugar, preservatives, refined foods, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, fertilizers, all that kind of stuff. I generally think that a plant-based diet tends to be healthier than a meat-based diet. And part of that is because of the adulteration that goes on. You know, a lot of animal farming, I don't know how it is in the States, but it is horrendous in where I am. You know, those animals are treated very badly. They're very unhappy, unhealthy animals. And if we are what we eat, then in some way that is reflected in our health, I think, you know, because a lot of these animals, are their only purpose is get them as fat as quickly as possible so that they render the most meat. And if we're going to take that, you know, hormones and God knows what else, then I'm sure that affects us as well. So I personally tend to prefer a plant-based diet wherever possible. I do think it's a good idea to supplement. I think so. Nutrition, I think, is really important. And I think nutrition, you know, we need to be more educated about nutrition, all of us. We need to be more educated about the dangers of things like artificial sweeteners.
Yeah.
because unfortunately, the problem again is just because it's got an FDA stamp of approval, that to my mind doesn't suddenly make it safe. You know, the FDA and all these places are hugely political organizations, and I think they have vested interests, etc. And therefore, I personally prefer organic food. I prefer homegrown, locally grown foods. I think we don't hydrate enough, and I think that's really important. I think exercise is very important. And I think one of the things that people don't talk about exercise is that exercise is a meditative experience. You know, when exercise is done, it's a form of meditation, and that's exceptionally important. People don't realize how helpful it is. I have a bunch of people who say, well, I'm up and down the stairs all day long when I'm at work, so I get plenty of exercise. That's not necessarily good exercise. That's stressful exercise. So that exercise where you can just channel everything out and, you know, zone in and just do the exercise can be very good. It also encourages, when we exercise, it does two things. One, it tells you that everything is going well. So usually if anything's going to go wrong with the heart, you'll first notice it on exercise. So exercising on a regular basis is a good thing because it tells you, it helps warn you beforehand. But also we know that exercise helps with formation of new blood vessels in the heart. So when people start developing heart disease, more exercise encourages more blood vessel formation, which is good. So exercise is important. I would say that there are two facets of lifestyle management which are hopelessly ignored, and that is sleep. And I think sleep is hugely important. And in America, 1 in 5 people now have sleep apnea, and it remains 85% of it is undiagnosed. So that's a problem. And then stress. I think stress, you know, because we're all sold the message, aren't we, that oh, work hard, play hard, and happiness around the corner. And then you keep doing that, and you get on this hamster wheel. And then by the time you come off the hamster wheel, you think, well, all those promises that were made, they've all gone. There's nothing here. Right. My children have left me because I was so busy. I was never had any time for them. And my pension is gone because, you know, they promised it, but they're not going to give it to me. And my health is gone because I've not concentrated on that. And so what am I left with? And then that breeds things like depression, etc. So very, very important to be cognizant of all that and actually enjoy life as it goes along rather than waiting for this thing at the end of these 30 years when you retire. That's when happiness will be. I think it's really important for us to kind of bear that in mind, that we're just being sold a message because we have to keep the system going, and we're all sort of little workers to keep the system going. And actually, the system is not really set out to make us happy or healthy. It's a self-fulfilling mechanism, really.
Absolutely, totally agree with you. It's so important to take time out to go enjoy yourself, to go on vacation, to spend time with your family. I mean, that's why I'm here in California. I'm still working, but thank God I get to, you know, work on a computer and be wherever I want to be to work. And I'm so thankful for that opportunity. But absolutely, you've got to take time out. You've got to rest. You have to enjoy yourself. So I tell my friends and clients is go have a cup of tea with a friend.
I think there are three other things that I wanted to quickly mention, which I've become more and more interested in, which may hold the key to, you know, better health. The first thing is this idea that actually, because there's so much sugar in our diet, you know, sugar is in everything. What we're probably doing is every time we take in sugar, we're spiking up our insulin levels. And then, you know, every time you do that, your insulin levels go up and up and up. And more people are now beginning to think that perhaps the harm is not, perhaps harm is from all this insulin that we're producing as a result of these sugar surges. And maybe that is why the damage starts happening before the sugar levels rise, you know, because actually the insulin is keeping the sugar levels low. So the sugar levels don't go up, but you've got this inflammatory process going on. And it is only when your insulin stops being produced and your pancreas gets really tired that your sugar levels go up. Well, the damage has already happened. So increasingly, I think that, you know, our understanding of diabetes has to change. Maybe many of us are diabetic without meeting the current definition. And we need to look a bit further and see whether we're developing all these kind of sugar spikes, et cetera. And now we have these monitoring devices which may allow us to do that. But that I think is really important, this idea of impaired glucose resistance, insulin resistance, you know. Insulin resistance is this thing that is happening to us before we become diabetic. And maybe that holds some of the key to why people get sick. The second thing that I think is really interesting is gut health. And what we're beginning to realize is that perhaps, you know, through what we're eating, through stress levels, our guts are allowing bacteria to get into our bodies, and those bacteria are causing inflammation, and maybe the inflammation then causes bad things to happen, causes premature aging of the vessels. So increasingly people are beginning to look into that, this idea of really paying close attention to what we're putting in our stomach and what it's doing for our gut health. And the third thing that I think is really interesting is this idea that when you get older, you see two things happen. One is that we get frailer. So we develop brittle bones, we develop more osteoporosis. And the second thing is we develop heart disease as we get older. And historically, we've thought of those as two separate things, you know, just a consequence of getting older. But it's very interesting because one is a condition of a lack of calcium, i.e. brittle bones, osteoporosis, frailty, lack of calcium. And heart disease is about too much calcium.
Oh.
And so that's really interesting because perhaps it may not be, perhaps there is a problem with how we signal our calcium. And instead of the calcium going to the right place, it starts going to the wrong place, i.e. our heart arteries. And now there is some really interesting research which shows that there is a vitamin that is responsible for that. And that is called vitamin K2. And you know, people are beginning to find that actually when you give patients vitamin K2, it can stabilize and it can even reverse some of the effects of coronary disease. Now, these aren't thoughts that are echoed by mainstream medicine, but that mainstream medicine, as you know, is servile to clinical guidelines. Clinical guidelines are servile to big, big studies. And no one's going to really make a lot of money with these things like vitamin K2. You know, you would much rather study some fancy pharmaceutical product that'll cost, you know, a bunch of money than try something like that. But I think as people who have all this information now available to us, we should always feel empowered to go and look and see, does the data make sense to us? Let's not worry about, oh, are the doctors recommending it? Let's do our own research and let's see whether, you know, it's, you know, and take some of this control back, this control that we've assigned to the medical profession, which is failing to fulfill our needs. So those three things I think are going to be really interesting as time progresses.
Absolutely, totally agree. Somebody was asking about the sleep apnea. Why the rise in sleep apnea? Is it that we're seeing it now, or is it something, but it's always been there, or is it something that's happening more?
I think, I mean, if you look at the average weight of the human being, the weight has gone up substantially over the last 30, 40 years. So we are heavier now than we've ever been.
Yeah.
And that, I think, it boils down to nutrition and the amount of sugar that's going in. And of course, things like stress, etc. So I think sleep apnea is, again, one of those manifestations of an unhappy body, you know, and I think these things all go hand in hand. Diabetes, high blood pressure, sleep apnea, obesity, you know, dementia. I think they're all different faces, different screams from the body. Heart disease, maybe they're not, we've always traditionally thought one is the parent of the other. Maybe they're all brothers. Maybe the problem is this inflammation that is going on in our bodies, right, which we're not targeting. We're looking at, you know, we're looking at sort of symptoms rather than dealing with the underlying condition.
Yeah, I get that. And gut health. I mean, I really think gut health has everything to do with our health for our whole body. And then that goes back to what we're putting into it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Gut health, mental health, all those things, you know, every different part of the body. Again, we have to stop thinking of these as different, completely isolated, different organ systems. It is all, you know, everything is needed. And so we have to have a holistic view. And we need to, when we see patients, we need to address their gut health, their mental health, their physical health, you know, all those things need to be tackled together. And you want to form a team around your patients rather than this idea where you come here, here's some pills, we'll see you in 6 months, you'll see another doctor, he'll give you some more pills because he can't be bothered to read your notes. And before you know it, 5 years go by, you're not getting any better, the number of medications are going up, and all that's happened is your quality of life has gotten worse.
Yeah, absolutely. So you guys heard it here first, gut health, you know, your diet. What are you putting into your body? Treat your body like a Porsche. Make sure you exercise. Don't eat all that sugar. It's not worth it. Any other last messages that you'd like to share?
I think, from my perspective, I think the important thing is, you know, I definitely think that there is a lot of fear out there. You know, the fear business is big business, right? You know, you think, okay, have you done, this could happen, this could happen. Have you had your blood pressure checked? This could happen. And then after all that, when you switch the TV on, oh, have you planned for your funeral?
Yeah.
Why not do that? There's so much fear. I mean, this is crazy. How is this even acceptable? You know? And so before you know it, people end up being enslaved in fear. And actually the problem, particularly in places like the West, is that there is a ton of anxiety. There's a ton of health-related anxiety. And I would say to people that actually fear doesn't stop you dying. You know, fear stops you living. So I personally very much believe in people taking control, taking back that control, and concentrating on your quality of life. Your quality of life, and your quality of life is your present is more important than anything else. No one knows what's going to happen in the future. Anyone who tells you otherwise is wrong or lying or trying to sell you something. The truth is, this is the time. Concentrate, take some time out for yourself. Concentrate on getting some exercise, spending some time with your loved ones, doing things that are creative and build you up and make you feel like you're growing in life. And as long as you do that, you're doing the best you can.
Absolutely. Perfect message. Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's a real privilege.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for joining in. And we have Dr. Gupta's information in the links if you want to go to his website or his YouTube channel and find out more about him. Thank you, everybody, for joining in.